Hello, I'm Chuck Weiss, and welcome to Close Encounters. I'll act as your guide while together we explore the twin phenomena of UFOs and alien abduction. I've been personally involved in the alien abduction phenomena since 1994, when the Greys awakened me to their presence in my life. I wrote a book about it called Abducted by Aliens, or How I Learned to Cope with High Strangeness, Government Harassment, and My Mother, a True Story. It's available as a free download at my website, abductedbyaliens.org. Although at first the primary purpose of ET visits seems to be focused on physical examinations, contactees who try to reach out to understand their new relationship with the visitors will discover that these beings are also interested in humans on a personal level. Early on, I came to understand that my ETs, specifically the Greys, were concerned about my welfare. But I couldn't say for sure that it wasn't because they wanted this human lab rat to be in good condition to run their maze. However, while human research scientists are usually only concerned with physical changes that may result from the experiments they perform on their lab animals, the Greys have, in addition to their genetic agenda, shown a great interest in abductee experiencers as individual personalities. Once you open yourself up to contact, the nature of your belief systems, the values and standards to which you hold yourself, and even the depth of your personal spirituality will be probed and tested. Over the years, I've been tested several times in different ways by my ETs, and I would like to tell you about three such incidences that affected me profoundly. My first test had to do with, would you believe, cockroaches. When we come back, I'll tell you about how one cockroach changed my life.
What is Copwatch? Copwatch is a network of activist organizations in the United States and Canada that observe and document police activity while looking for signs of police misconduct and police brutality. Their database is a permanent searchable repository of complaints filed against police officers at copwatch.org. You can report an incident for permanent inclusion in their database at copwatch.org. This public service announcement is brought to you by your friends at Muni Radio in San Francisco.
And now, coming to the stage, a public service announcement from the Laughter Foundation. Are you funny? Do you exhibit signs of being a comedian? Do you find yourself constantly making a room full of strangers laugh? Do you find yourself stressing out about not knowing where your next comedy gig is coming from? Do you sometimes find yourself depressed for no apparent reason? You may be suffering from being a stand-up comedian. My name is Stephen Allen Green, the founder of the Laughter Foundation. We here at the Laughter Foundation know that with comedy creativity often comes natural side effects such as depression and confusion. I urge anyone who is suffering from depression, especially professional stand-up comedians, to seek out professional help immediately. Therapy literally saved my life. Plus, therapy can help you creatively. Don't suffer silently. Your demons are just hecklers who can be thrown out of the comedy club in your head. Contact your local psychiatric services and don't be ashamed. Get the help that you need and deserve. If you are feeling imminently suicidal, contact the local suicide hotline immediately. And contact us too. We always have new ideas and can connect you to a mental health care professional. Don't feel ashamed. We understand and support you. After all, there is no greater nobility than making the world laugh. And sometimes, that's just a bit too much of a burden. We need and must take care of our own. Thank you for your time and for your services to the comedy community. Find us at thelaughterfoundation.org.
Thank you.
Today I'm featuring the music of Vangelis. That was Sword of Orion from his album Albedo 0.39. As with most of the bumper music on this show, Vangelis is best enjoyed with a good pair of earphones. Today's podcast is about a part of the ET contact agenda that doesn't get much attention within the UFO community. In addition to the medical monitoring of select family bloodlines, the ETs are also concerned with the ethical and spiritual development of their human contacts. Some researchers believe that the nasal implants, some of which have been recovered from abductee experiencers, and the spontaneous nosebleeds they apparently generate, are meant to stimulate the frontal lobes of the human brain. This area of the brain is a recent evolutionary development and is where all our higher impulses are located, such as our feelings of compassion and our sense of justice. Many years ago, I made a vow not to kill except for food or in self-defense. It was done in a moment of self-righteousness, and quite honestly, I didn't give it much thought afterwards. In early 1995, however, I renewed my vow most solemnly, just after I squashed a cockroach in my bathroom. Some months before, I had taken the studio apartment vacated by my good friend Dick Mayfield, who had moved into a local hospice in preparation of his impending death from prostate cancer. He had grown tired of the fight and was ready to die. When he gave up on life, life evidently reciprocated. The building is old and made of brick and mortar, and with thick walls and solid wooden doors. Unfortunately, structures of this kind and age, especially ones in large urban areas, are often infested with cockroaches, and my building is no exception. They were everywhere when I moved in, and I was flattening as many as I could, as fast as I could. On this day, however, I was feeling particularly spiritual after several visits that week from my ETs and the corresponding nosebleeds I had afterwards. After I killed the cockroach, I remembered my old pledge and felt ashamed that I had not considered, until that moment, that the right to live included roaches, insects, and all other bugs. I was also struck by how reflexively I had killed that roach. I killed it not because it threatened me in any way, but because it was what it was, a cockroach. How indifferent of me. I thought for a while, and then decided to firmly renew my pledge, and to extend to even the roaches the protection of my vow. It was a defining moment, and I knew it at the time. Immediately afterwards, I was stunned by the excited reaction of the many invisible beings that were with me that day. It was as if they shouted in my ear, their collective voice like a Greek chorus, bridging the gap between dimensions. I heard and felt them shout, "He got it!" It was a vow that was hard to keep, to be sure. My family thought me crazy, a nice guy in many respects, but certifiable nonetheless. I often thought that their reaction would have been much different if I had shaved my head and wore salmon-colored sarongs. If I looked like a Buddhist monk, I'd be permitted to extend my feelings of brotherhood to all living creatures without fear of ridicule. But if I look Western in dress, I must act Western indeed, which means separating the material from the spiritual aspects of my life. We shouldn't confuse people now, should we? Keeping my word was difficult in other respects, too. The roaches would gather under the rim of the commode in the bathroom, and whenever I needed to use the toilet, I would have to get down on my knees and collect them, lest they drowned when I flushed. In retrospect, it was pretty funny at times, when I would be dancing a jig to keep from peeing in my pants while trying to save the cockroaches from a watery grave. After months of this, I finally had enough and asked the ETs to do something. It wasn't long thereafter that I stopped finding them in their usual hiding place under the rim of the commode. I kept checking for a while, just to make sure, but my plea had evidently been heard and acted upon. I was very grateful to be relieved of the commode watch. Catherine, my daughter, who was about 10 years old then, was helped to overcome her fear of bugs when I paid her for each roach she could scoop up in a cup and throw out my two-story window. At first, 2 cents was enough to satisfy her, but as the months wore on, it grew to a nickel through collective bargaining, and finally to 10 cents when she threatened a strike. My girlfriend at the time wasn't pleased, to say the least. She once threatened to leave me if I didn't do something to rid my apartment of the roaches. It was either them or her, she demanded. Maybe it was the unhesitating way I responded when I told her I didn't have a choice in the matter, and that if she pushed the issue, she wouldn't like the answer. Fortunately, I made the no-kill commitment before we had met, so it wasn't as if she faced a bait-and-switch situation. It was her decision to stay or leave, and when she saw my resolve, she didn't say anything more on the subject. She did, however, take me to see Joe's apartment when it came out. It's a movie, part action, part animated, about the dating problems of a guy living in an apartment, crawling with intelligent, talking cockroaches that sing and dance, too. About a year later, I came home and found that the landlord had come in and planted roach motels throughout my apartment. I removed as many as I could, but felt defeated in my attempt to keep my apartment free from violence of any kind. I was truly saddened. The roaches disappeared, however, and I was never again bothered by their company. The landlord hadn't sprayed any pesticides in my apartment, as tenants could opt out of that part of the extermination process if they wanted, and I had. The few roach motels that I found couldn't have accounted for the sudden lack of infestation. I think the ETs came and rounded up the cockroaches to take them where I do not know. I've been free of the roaches ever since, but I found out that my neighbors on this floor of the building are not so lucky. Their apartments are repeatedly infested, and I'm told the landlord is planning another extermination. My neighbors are much cleaner in their habits than I'm embarrassed to admit, so I can only attribute my good fortune to the ETs who have evidently given me a passing grade and determined that I no longer need testing in that area. As an aside, I'm reminded of a later incident when Catherine and her mother and I were vacationing as a family driving across country. We stopped at a gas station that was infested with mosquitoes. Margaret and Catherine ran from the car to the mini-mart across from the pumps to pay in advance and use the restroom. I stayed behind and pumped the gas, all the while repeating the mantra just under my breath, "I do not kill, please do not bite. I do not kill, please do not bite." After we all packed back into the car, Margaret and Catherine were covered with mosquito bites. Even though I had been outdoors for a much longer time than they had, I counted only 2 or 3 on me. They were incredulous, despite the evidence. I was pleased to read that my compassion for insects and bugs, thought by most people to be pests and worthy of extermination, is felt by other experiencers, too. The late Dr. John Mack described in his second book on the subject of UFO abduction the thoughts of Carlos Diaz of Mexico City. Mr. Diaz feels so connected to life that he can't turn away the trail of ants that invades his home to avoid inclement weather. They are safe with him until the sun comes out, when he takes them back outside. "They come into the house to seek shelter from the rain," he said. "The poor things have to have a place to stay overnight." He sounds like someone I'd like to meet someday. Dr. Mack also described the case of Jim Sparks and how the ETs tested him to see how willing he was to kill. He was shown a huge ant that he estimated to be 18 inches long, along with the word kill and a symbol that conveyed the meaning and power of killing. Jim was then commanded to press the symbol and thus kill the ant. He refused. They made his defiance painful and increased the pain each time he refused to kill the ant. When that didn't work, they showed him an image of his brother gasping at his chest as if in the throes of a heart attack, and said that he would die if Jim didn't kill the ant. He at last complied, pressing the symbol for kill, and watched the ant curl up and died. Sobbing, he asked the ETs, "Why did you do this to me?" They responded by telling him, "We had to be sure." "To be sure of what?" Jim asked. "That you are not a killer, and you're not," they assured him. If one is open to it, the alien contact experience can transcend its physical aspects and lead to a relationship with the ETs whereby one is made civilized enough to work closely with higher beings. Choosing not to kill even that which our society says should be exterminated, is the first step to becoming a truly civilized person, and it appears that more and more experiencers are making that choice. It's time for another break, so you can listen to these important messages. When we come back, I'll tell you what I learned when the Grays tested me with my personal hero.
Safe sex is more than just avoiding STIs and pregnancy, no matter what you're into. Make sure that you and those around you feel safe, comfortable, and are having a good time. This public service announcement is brought to you by your friends at Mutiny Radio.
The House of Pride radio show, LGBT radio for everyone.
Funky interviews, funky beats, talking drag queens, and much, much more. It's LGBT radio for everyone.
Listen live every Wednesday, 6 to 8 p.m. House of Pride radio, LGBT radio for everyone. Celebrating the considerable contributions of the LGBT community in San Francisco and beyond. Every Wednesday, 6 to 8 p.m. Listen here for hot new local beats by LGBT artists and listen to live interviews. Tune in. Turn on every Wednesday, 6 to 8 p.m., House of Pride Radio with drag queen personalities, ooh, Tweeka Turner and Pearl Tees.
We'll be right back.
That was Pulsar by Vangelis, again from his album Albedo 0.39. I believe I was given a test to determine how I would react when I met a hero figure. This test was administered as a dream in which I met my personal hero, someone I highly regarded and wanted to be like. We spent time together in a dream, doing something, what, I don't remember. I could tell, though, that he really liked me, even though he was a big movie star and I was just an average person, and it made me feel good to be accepted by someone I admired. The experience was profound, and when I woke up at 3 a.m, I didn't want to break the mood of the dream that was still with me, so I didn't turn on the lights. I sat in the dark, and the first 4 lines of a poem started to run through my mind. Someone I wanted to meet, someone I wanted to know, someone I wanted to be like, my own personal hero. I repeated those lines over and over again to commit them to memory. Here is the poem that I wrote the next morning. Dreaming of a hero. Someone I wanted to meet, someone I wanted to know, someone I wanted to be like, my own personal hero. I met him in a dream last night, and he became my friend. But when the dream was over, I knew it was not the end, for I learned something important as I lay there in my sleep, that we can't be like other people, we have our own lives to keep, and each and every one of us is a hero in his day, to his family, his friends, and those he meets along the way. So thank you, Harrison, although we never met, you helped me learn a lesson that I won't easily forget. Years later, I learned that Catherine also had a dream of her hero, actually 3 dreams on 3 consecutive nights. She was delighted to meet and be with her idol at the time, Leonardo DiCaprio. I can't count how many times I saw the movie Titanic with her. It would be interesting to know if other abductee experiencers have had dreams of their personal heroes. Whom we look up to and admire says a lot about us as individuals. In our Western culture, with its emphasis on entertainment, actors and other media celebrities are so revered that occasionally we even elect them to public office. Whether or not it was the lesson the ETs were trying to administer, I do not know, but I did learn something that night. We shouldn't look up to other people as if somehow, in some way, they are greater than us. Each of us has qualities that others can appreciate and admire. We all learn from each other. We can be an example as we go about our daily routine, living our lives as a quiet hero for others to emulate. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I'll tell you how the ETs tested my strength of character, a test that I utterly failed. We'll be right back. That was Heyo from Vangelis' third solo album called Earth. What I'm about to tell you is very personal, but to explain the incredible lengths to which the ETs will go to administer their tests and what it reveals about the nature of who and what they are, I must be perfectly frank, even if it means revealing a secret that I normally keep to myself. It will shock some and dismay others, and even once resulted in my book being burned, an incident I'll describe in a future podcast. The Greys I've been in contact with are spiritual, but not religious, although they use the myths and symbols of Earth's religions to communicate with experiencers about spiritual concepts. If you believe that Jesus of Nazareth was the Christ, then they will use the Jesus legends and Christian symbols to prepare for you spiritual tests, which, when completed successfully, become spiritual lessons learned. You don't have to be a Christian, though, or even believe in one supreme being to be the subject of these tests. I offer myself as a personal example. I am a pagan. I honor many gods and goddesses. I am not a Wiccan, though I respect their beliefs, and certainly share many of them. Wiccans, though, usually confine themselves to casting spells of healing, using the energies of the nature gods. On occasion, they may be induced to provide a love potion or a mojo bag for some lonely soul or someone down on their luck, but that's usually the extent of their meddling in the natural order of things. My approach has been much more hands-on. Let me explain. Every religion has its right and left-hand paths of spirituality. The majority of people of any religion follow the right-hand path, honoring their deities by giving up to them, evoking the power of the faithful through prayer or some other heartfelt emotional release of energy, such as tribal dancing, for example. There are always a few who instead choose to follow the left-hand path, learning to draw down, invoking into themselves the power of a god or goddess, so that they may use that power to alter the natural flow of energies and achieve results that would otherwise be highly improbable. This is the art of sorcery, the realm of magic. As I said, every religion has a less-traveled left-hand path to approach the divine. Jews have their Kabbalah, Catholics have their Knights Templar, and indigenous peoples the world over have their shamans. The example of the American Indian is probably the best illustration. Their medicine man was equivalent to the village priest. In addition to dispensing cures for all that ailed his charges, he was sought after in council, his words well respected. He was welcomed throughout his society, and many young men sought him out to learn from him. But outside the camp, up in the hills, if there be any nearby, lived the shaman. He was a darker version of the medicine man, and, while also respected, he was also generally avoided. He communicated his advice only to the elders of the tribe, and only the very brave would seek him out for spiritual guidance, for he would take them, through the ingesting of sacred plants, to the very edge of life itself, to death's door, to show them the divinity that is within everyone. For my spiritual quest in this life, I walk the left-hand path. My training is that of a ritual magician, learning from the writings of Arthur Waite, Israel Rigardi, and Aleister Crowley, among others, as well as at the side of two skilled practitioners who taught me well. I've practiced a modern form of ancient Egyptian magic for over a quarter of a century, and I'm pretty good at it. I also lead a small circle of fellow magicians and teach a few selected students. By practicing magic, I make the conscious decision every day to be in charge of my own karmic bank account. Magic allows those skilled in its art to change the course of their lives beyond what was originally programmed for them through the process of reincarnation. When the magic is turned inward, it can be a fast track to personal growth. A year practicing magic can be worth 10 on the psychiatrist's couch. However, those who would separate themselves from the natural order of things must examine each of their decisions in life to confirm that they were made in balance with truth and justice. Not to do so is to almost guarantee self-destruction. While the left-hand path can be used as a shortcut to personal transformation, it is a treacherous one to tread and should not be attempted without guidance from someone who has gone before. In preparation for the story to follow, let me explain that there are three basic types of magic ritual. One, those that employ positive energies to create. Two, those that use negative energies to destroy. And three, lust rituals, which are outside our discussion here. As a magician, I would most often use my talents for the benign benefit of myself, my family, and my friends. But on rare occasion, I would muster the negative energies of the universe against those who sought to do me harm. I'm normally a peaceful person, but I learn to fight back when someone attacks me. Knowing as I do the power of magic and how to wield it, I could and would retaliate against those foolish enough to attack me. Unlike other victims who are powerless against brutish people, I had the tools to come back at them tenfold, and I did. If they were foolish enough to purposely step on a scorpion, then they deserve to get stung, I reasoned. Let me say that this is not something I would do casually. In almost 30 years of practicing magic, I can count the number of times I've done a ritual in anger on one hand and still have a finger or two left over. I reserved my ultimate weapon for only those I thought to be the most deserving. The tale I'm about to relate is true. Although it is one that is embarrassing to tell, the telling is necessary. It was the mid-1990s, and I was hired to work for a government agency of a nearby county. The commute was long, but the pay was good, and the job came with full benefits. I was hired the same day as one other new employee, and we followed one another throughout the first day's orientations and presentations. At first, she was friendly enough, but her demeanor toward me turned cold when I saw her take notice of the ring I was wearing. It was the simple design of a five-pointed star with a circle around it, known as the pentagram. It is a sacred religious symbol recognized as such by all pagans. I wore it and looked at it often because it would help ground me each time I did. Knowing that most people are ignorant of the real meaning of the pentagram and believe it to be tied to devil worship, regardless of its orientation of up or down, many pagans are reluctant to flaunt it in public. Mary, not her real name, wore a crucifix in public display around her neck, yet she was offended by my ring. Go figure. This type of religious prejudice doesn't surprise me, and I quickly forgot about it. Later that day, we were both assigned to the same office, and eventually we found ourselves on the same night shift with another woman, who I'll call Barbara. The three of us would take our dinner hour together, sampling the restaurants within driving distance and alternating responsibility for the bill. Over the following weeks, Mary's attitude toward me softened as the three of us bonded during this break in our nightly work schedule. She even offered to set me up with a date. I was reluctant, but she insisted and invited her friend to our dinner hour so that we could meet. I promised nothing. I was friendly during the meal, but didn't encourage anything further. Miriam, Barbara were puzzled as to why I wasn't available. "No, I'm not gay," I told them. "Then what is it?" they asked. They were nothing if not persistent. I decided to let them read my journal. I knew that this would stop the matchmaking. I had learned from past attempts at dating that unless they were abductees or experiencers themselves, most women found it difficult to share me with space aliens. I must admit, though, that I had another motive for letting them read my journal. I badly needed to talk to somebody about my ET experiences. The one support group in the area was a good 4-hour drive round trip and only met once a month. I had stopped documenting all my episodes of high strangeness during this period, so I can't remember what was happening then, but I do remember the need I had for support at that time. We had a couple of months of friendship between us, so I felt that Mary and Barbara probably wouldn't think me a liar or crazy, and might even believe me. Mary read it first, then passed it to Barbara a couple of days later as I waited patiently to get their reaction. Barbara had had it for over a week when I asked if she was close to finishing it. She told me that she had finished it days earlier, but that Mary had wanted it back to reread certain parts. I asked Mary, and she returned it the next night. Mary's reaction was incredulous, but supportive. Barbara was quicker to believe and was also very sympathetic. Their support buoyed me, and I felt that I had finally found a good job working with good people. Our night shift began an hour before the day shift ended. It was a couple of weeks after I came out to my workmates about my ET experiences, and shortly after I arrived at work one afternoon, when Mary approached me and asked me about my ring. "What does it mean?" she asked. "It's just a star," I replied. There were other people in the room, so it wasn't the time or place for me to explain the pentagram to Mary. That would have to wait for our dinner hour, I thought. A few minutes later, I was asked to step into the office by my supervisor. When I did, I was introduced to a man from the county's legal department. After the supervisor left the room, the attorney told me that I had just been fired. Mary had filed a sexual harassment complaint against me. I was dumbfounded. When I professed my innocence, he asked me if I had ever shown Mary a picture of my penis. I couldn't believe my ears. "Of course not," I said. He gave me a dirty look and produced a piece of paper from a folder on the table. When I turned it over, I realized what Mary had done, and what a naive fool I had been. There in front of me was a page from the back of my journal, a diagram I had drawn of the scar on my penis. I protested that they were taking it out of context, and that Mary hadn't given me any indication that the drawing had upset her. The stern demeanor that the lawyer had projected until that moment softened. He said, although my work had been satisfactory, Mary had threatened to sue the county, and, because my mandatory 3-month probationary period had not expired, the county could let me go without cause. In other words, it was easier and cheaper to fire me than to fight a lawsuit. Her treachery had been complete. When I gave them my journal, Mary had read it first and then passed it to Barbara, only to ask for it back again. She had obviously made her plans at that time and wanted the journal back from Barbara to copy it to use against me later. As a good Christian, in her mind at least, she had struck a blow for her God. She probably got her inspiration from her Bible, that passage where it says it's okay to kill witches. I think there's something also about pagans. At that time, there were no legal guidelines for companies or government agencies to follow when faced with incidences of alleged sexual harassment. Mary's threats to management wouldn't have gotten her anywhere nowadays. Today, just one incident doesn't qualify. It must be repeated over the objections of the victim to rise to the level of harassment. This was not a repeat incident. In fact, she had said nothing about the drawing or indicated to me that anything I had written had upset her. If anything, I was guilty of extreme stupidity, but certainly not sexual harassment. Just for the record, I want to say that I would never sexually harass anyone. It's just not in me. I'm not that kind of person. I've been attacked and badly wounded. The loss of my job was a heavy blow and one I felt I couldn't leave unanswered. My pride as a magician wouldn't allow it. I immediately set about planning a ritual to retaliate. I performed it on a Tuesday night to access Mars' energy. Mars is the god of war and ruthless when unleashed. My anger was immense and it fueled the ritual to great heights. When it was done, I knew that vengeance was mine. I learned 2 or 3 months later, when I got a call from Barbara, just how effective my ritual had been. She told me that Mary had been fired for poor performance and that her husband had been diagnosed with leukemia. As part of the ritual, I made a stipulation that anyone who had urged her to file her false claim against me would share equally in her punishment. My ritual had obviously been a success. Little did I know then that it had also been a test, one which I was to find out years later I had utterly failed. After 2 years of sporadic employment, I was eventually led through an agency to a temporary assignment with a possible permanent hire at the end of a 3-month contract. I say I was led there because it soon became stunningly obvious to me that my job at that particular company, even to the specific department to which I eventually was assigned, had been predetermined long before I even applied at the employment agency that sent me there. Months earlier, the ET showed me, in a dream that wasn't a dream, the exact proprietary reports I wound up working with at my new company and told me to study them carefully, which I did. When those very same reports were handed to me on the job, I was struck speechless. After I recovered, I felt humbled and so very grateful to the ETs for providing me with gainful employment. When you don't know from 1 week to the next how you'll pay your rent at the first of the month, it can be a very stressful situation. While I was happy to have a regular paycheck again, I was later to learn that providing me with financial security was not the reason the ETs had led me to my new job. The small office to which I was eventually assigned housed a team of four people, one of whom was now me. The winter holiday season was in full swing. Since I had no money to buy presents, I offered to chart the horoscopes of my co-workers and provide them with a full written report describing in lay terms what it all meant, if they would but provide me with the date of their birth and the city in which they were born. I have a good astrology computer program, and I presented each of my co-workers with a printout of their horoscopes as my holiday gift to them. A couple of days later, one of my co-workers, I'll call him Jason, asked me if I had read his horoscope before I had given it to him. I didn't stop to think and said something like, "Oh, of course, I like to know who I'm working with." It was a snappy answer, but one that made me an enemy. When I checked his horoscope afterwards, the computer-generated report described him, in what I later learned was with stunning accuracy, as being determined to always get his way, even if it meant, quote, resorting to guile and subterfuge. The man was a genius at ingratiating himself with our department manager, and soon he was socializing with her in her office with the door closed and his feet up on the desk. The office had windows. At about this time, I noticed a cooling in my interactions with my supervisors. I was now being treated as if they were sorry that they had hired me as a permanent employee. I couldn't understand it because my productivity, which was tracked weekly, was as good as anyone's and sometimes better. Jason had poisoned the waters for me. Of that I was sure. I was seriously contemplating doing another destruction ritual in answer to his treachery, because the man was obviously evil, and even said so in his horoscope. As I thought about the situation, I was suddenly struck as if by lightning when I remembered that Jason and I both started work on the same day. We had both been temps from different agencies and could have wound up in different departments, but after some back-and-forth negotiations between the supervisors, we were both assigned to the same small office. I do not believe in coincidence. What was happening in my new job so exactly matched what had happened when I worked for that county agency years ago. I had been stabbed in the back both times by someone who had been hired the same day I had by a large employer, with both of us being assigned to a similar small work team of three or four people. The realization of what the ETs had done struck me full force. I realized then that Mary and her charge of sexual harassment those many months earlier had been a test of my character, a test that I had failed miserably. How small I felt at that moment. But it went further than that. I was suddenly confronted with ethical questions about the spiritual path that I had chosen. Was it wrong to retaliate as I did? The ETs obviously thought so, I reasoned, because they were now offering me the opportunity to either repeat my mistake or to choose a different approach to the problem. And what exactly was my mistake, anyway? Was it to react to Mary's betrayal by doing a ritual that was propelled by anger and a thirst for revenge? Was even practicing ritual magic itself a problem for my ETs? With these questions running through my mind, I finally looked inward for the answers. Magic was not the problem, I decided. It was all about how I used power. The biblical equation of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth was originally a Jewish legal reform long before it became a call for vengeance. It meant that by law you could only extract like kind in payment for an injury. You could only take an eye for an eye. You couldn't kill a man for robbing you, for example. It served to put limits on the punishments that could be meted out by the men with power to do so. Through the power of magic, I had the ability to punish Mary in any way I wished, and I called upon the help of some pretty nasty demons to do it, not what you would call a measured response. My response to Jason's backstabbing still used magic, but this time I did it differently. Jason had often said that he really wished that he could work behind the scenes in television. I decided to give him what he wanted. My ritual was planned around bringing him an offer he couldn't refuse from any of the several television stations in the area. About 3 months later, he was telling everyone at work that he had just accepted a position at the local public broadcasting station. I was finally rid of him and his poisoning influence with my supervisors, and this time there was no blood on my hands. It took 2 years after Jason left to repair my damaged reputation with the company, but I was rewarded in the end with stock options that were only offered to a few of their most prized employees. I had finally been vindicated. However, after 9/11, the company closed its satellite operations and moved everything back to their home office in Texas. I was unemployed yet again. This last test of character was enormous in scope and flawless in execution. It had been 2 years between the jobs, yet they were most definitely connected. Many lives had to be manipulated to set up my retest and make possible that moment of clarity when I realized what was happening. Different employment agencies had to send Jason and me separately to the same company, and the supervisors at that company had to come to an agreement as to where to put us. There were three different departments that were vying for the new temps, and it was originally thought that we would go in different directions, but instead they assigned Jason and me to the same small office. It wasn't an accident. I was meant to be struck by the unlikely similarities of the two situations that, although years apart, were almost identical in nature. It was like being hit with a sledgehammer. It got my attention, and I had to consider the implications. I wouldn't have thought to have dealt with Jason's backstabbing any differently than I had done with Mary's treachery if it weren't for that revelation. It was only then that I was able to grow spiritually, by putting self-imposed limits on my use of power. I still practice magic, but I hope more responsibly now. The, quote, coincidence of Mary and Jason was a graphic illustration to me of the power that the ETs have over our lives. They showed me that they can, with ease, manipulate the life of anyone they choose and will do so in order to offer a specific individual the opportunity to grow spiritually. Who are these people? Let me attempt to answer that question. I've come to understand that the Greys are interdimensional beings from the next higher plane of existence, and that they are specifically charged and guided by even higher beings with maintaining the cosmic mechanism of reincarnation. They program the lives of us flawed human beings so that major events set up opportunities that help us to grow spiritually. Where we live, what kind of people we meet and befriend, what careers we follow, and even whom we marry and have children by, are all predetermined by these higher beings. While we have our own set of individual tests to undergo throughout life, we are also manipulated so as to be a part of the testing of other people. Life on this earth is one big school, and through our interactions, we teach each other the lessons we're meant to learn. This is the major principle of reincarnation, a spiritual belief held by the majority of the world's population. I'm certainly not the first person to suggest that the Greys are spiritual in nature. Dr. Mack also noted this common thread amongst some experiencers. Quote, even when abductees initially experience the beings themselves, especially the now well-known small gray figures with huge black eyes, as instigators of great fear and trauma, over time they may come to see them as odd spirit guides, closer to the ultimate creative principle source than humans, even as emissaries of the divine. Whitley Strieber wrote, I forget in which of his books, that when he protested to the Greys that they had no right to take him, they responded by saying that he certainly did have the right, and later told him that they recycle souls, a clear reference to reincarnation. Raymond Fowler, the UFO researcher who brought to the world the case of Betty Andreasen Lucas, cites instances where Greys were seen at the bedsides of people just before they died, and says that his research over many years leads him to the conclusion that, quote, UFOs and their entities come from behind death's great door, end quote. UFO researchers were reluctant for years to publicly comment on what they were talking about in private, that there is a strong spiritual component to the ET agenda. Many remained silent because they feared ridicule and loss of credibility, others because they had no context in which they could place the new information. Why would ETs be concerned with human spirituality? They asked. Are the spiritual transformations that many experiencers report an actual part of the ET agenda, along with their genetic sampling and hybrid program? Or is it an unintended consequence of the abduction experience itself? Again, Dr. Mack put it this way, quote, the third dimension of the abduction phenomena might variously be defined as growth engendering or spiritual. One of the most intense debates in this field occurs around the question of whether these changes in the psyche of experiencers, no researcher seems to deny that such change, even transformation, does in fact occur in some cases, is an intrinsic aspect of the phenomena, even its purpose or intention, or is instead a kind of byproduct reflecting human creativity, resilience, and adaptability in the face of traumatic challenge, or is even the result of alien trickery or deception. Having no answer to that question and knowing that they certainly would be asked it, UFO researchers by and large simply ignored the mounting evidence and remained silent on the subject, at least publicly. But the evidence of spiritual testing, as described by Jim Sparks, myself, and others, is building and cannot be ignored any longer. If we are indeed being visited by the masters of reincarnation, as I believe I have confirmed, then their interest in our spirituality is certainly understandable. This is a good place to take a break. When we come back, I'll continue where I left off last week with a dramatic reading of my book, Abducted by Aliens. A free PDF copy is also available as a download at my website, abductedbyaliens.org. But first, this message.
Volunteer for the San Francisco Food Bank. The San Francisco Food Bank relies on volunteers like you to help sort, package, and distribute healthy food to people in need in San Francisco. Each year, over 22,000 people contribute thousands of hours to fighting hunger in our community. This support will enable the SF Food Bank to distribute 43.5 million pounds of food this year, enough for 93,000 meals every day. But they can't do it without volunteers. Visit www.sffoodbank.org/volunteer. Again, www.sffoodbank.org/volunteer to find out how you can help.
Thank you.
That was Alpha by Vangelis from his album Albedo 0.39. Last week, I added a new segment at the end of my Close Encounter podcasts, a dramatic reading of my book Abducted by Aliens, or How I Learned to Cope with High Strangeness, Government Harassment, and My Mother, a True Story. Reading from my diary, that is the first part of my book, I described how I was awakened to ETs in my life in January of 1994, how unseen entities gave me a spontaneous healing after a painful exercise injury, and how I came to discover an extensive scar on my genitals that my doctor could not explain. I'm going to pick up where I left off on page 18 of Abducted by Aliens by Chuck Weiss, copyrighted 2008. Monday, March 28, 1994. Although I've been interested in the UFO phenomena for many years, I purposely have stayed away from the subject of alien abduction. The idea of people being floated out of their bedrooms by beings from outer space just seemed too preposterous to consider seriously. Now, I'm not so sure. I bought a video entitled Contact UFO Alien Abduction. I don't know why I bought it. As I said, I wouldn't normally consider such a fantastic explanation for my problems. In fact, I picked it up and put it down several times before finally taking it to the checkout counter. Something just clicked inside of me when I saw it, and I had to buy it. A number of physical and emotional symptoms are described in the video as being common among those who supposedly have been abducted by UFOs. They are identical with what is called post-traumatic stress disorder, a condition found among people who have undergone a traumatic event such as Vietnam veterans or Middle East hostages. The disturbing thing is that I recognize these symptoms as having been persistent problems for me off and on these many years. I believe now that they contributed to the disintegration of my marriage. At that time, I thought I was suffering from chronic fatigue syndrome and tried unsuccessfully to confirm that with my doctor. Here is a list of my symptoms. 1. I experience projectile vomiting, stomach acid shooting up into the mouth, while I'm sleeping. My doctor says that for this to happen while a person is asleep is unheard of medically. 2. I'll go through periods of time when I behave compulsively. These include eating and shopping binges. I've maxed out my credit cards this way because I just can't stop myself when this happens. 3. At times it's hard to concentrate, except on the simplest of tasks. 4. During these times it's very hard to motivate myself, either to do everyday chores or sometimes even to physically move from my spot. 5. I have facial tics that come and go. These are almost always supposed to be indications of extreme stress. 6. There are periods when my heart will suddenly begin racing. This is always accompanied by feelings of high anxiety. 7. I can't sleep more than 2 or 3 hours before waking up. I'll nod off easily during the day, but again, I can't sleep more than a couple of hours at a time. 8. I also cry easily, but not about anything that concerns me personally. I get emotional over things like compassion and feelings of humanity, or rather the lack of such in our society. Except for the last two symptoms, which are constant, they all seem to come on strong at first and then diminish over time until they disappear entirely. Afterwards, there are usually a few months when my anxiety and depression are under control, but the cycle always begins again with renewed intensity. I need to learn more about this thing called alien abduction. Wednesday, March 30th. I went to see my friend Lila and took my journal. After she read it, she offered alternative explanations for almost every concern. The audio hallucinations could be the result of a desire to hear the phone ring, as my telephone brings me business. She reminded me that Saul, a friend of mine, died about the time I began hearing them. Besides the friendship we developed over the years, as a client he also represented $1,000 of income per month in my medical transportation business. For a one-person operation, the loss of $12,000 a year of income can certainly be a cause of anxiety. The scratches and scrapes I found on my body can be explained by my wearing a watch to bed every night, she said. We are always hurting ourselves in minor ways and then only discovering it afterwards. She felt that even the scar on my genitals could be explained, saying that sometimes boys are born with large amounts of foreskin that has to be cut off. We agreed that such a procedure might not even be mentioned to the parents, especially if it were performed as part of a standard circumcision. The symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder could be the result of depression, she suggested, caused by both a bad marriage and, more recently, Saul's death. She suggested antidepressant medication. The one issue she didn't address was the exercise injury and its sudden healing. Neither of us mentioned that one. It's a hard one to explain away. I bought a book about alien abductions titled Communion, A True Story. I think it was one of the first books published on the subject. In it, the author, Whitley Strieber, describes how they inserted a long needle into his brain. The next morning, he purportedly discovered a scab on the top of his head composed of crystallized blood granules, just as I did, and felt afterwards that he was being monitored. Did they flood my body with endorphins after my injury on the exercise machine? If so, then they somehow can monitor my body and or my thoughts. How else did they respond so quickly? This is a frightening thought. Even to think such a thought is frightening. In my business, I transfer mental health patients to locked mental wards, many of whom claim to be monitored or controlled by unseen forces. However, I must admit I do feel better after talking with Lila. I'll defer judgment on all this, but will continue to report anything unusual that happens. Monday, April 4th. Last night I had a memory of something that happened a long time ago in childhood. It was triggered by something I read over the weekend in Communion. I still haven't completed the book. I have about a third of it left. It's not that long, but for some reason I'm hesitant to continue reading it, even though each chapter seems to confirm my own experiences. It's like I don't want to know, but I need to know. Under hypnosis, Strieber described an encounter with the visitors, as he calls them, when he was about 12 years old. He and his sister were playing in an empty lot close to home when something approached them. Afterwards, his sister told their mother that there was a fireball in the lot, and that's why they ran home. Lying in bed last night, I suddenly remembered an incident that happened when I was a young boy at my grandparents' home in Oklahoma. I heard Happy, my grandmother was nicknamed Happy, and it well suited her. I heard Happy shout, "A fireball just landed in the driveway! A fireball just landed in the driveway!" I think I was in the big bedroom at the time, where I didn't have a direct view of the driveway, but I can't be sure. I also have some kind of memory of being in the living room, trying to get at the curtains to look out the window, which did face directly onto the driveway. At any rate, I have a distinct memory of my grandmother's voice becoming more and more agitated. "There's someone at the front door," she shouted. "They're coming through the front door." My mother and grandfather tried to calm her, saying, "See, there's no one at the door, Happy. There's nothing in the driveway." "I saw a fireball in the driveway," she insisted. I think it was my mother who, trying to make sense of it all, suggested that the driveway might have been struck by lightning, which could have then formed a fireball of electricity. Almost as soon as it was suggested, this explanation was discarded because no one had heard a thunderclap, which would have certainly followed any lightning strike so close to the house. I have no memory of it raining, either, for that matter. I think it was a sunny afternoon, in fact. Mother also reasoned that lightning would have scorched the driveway, although I don't recall anyone leaving the house to inspect the area. I did so, but only after I got home from school the next day. I remember I inspected the driveway carefully and found nothing out of the ordinary. I haven't thought about this incident since it happened. When that was, I don't remember exactly. I think it was shortly after my parents separated when Mother and I left Father in California to live with my grandparents in Oklahoma. I called Mother tonight and asked her if she remembered any such incident. I was hoping for an independent confirmation, but she doesn't remember anything. She asked if I was confusing her with Nancy, Happy's best friend, who often came to visit. But if that were true, I would have certainly been playing with one of Nancy's daughters, either Felicia, who is my age, or Tina, who is 2 years older. They always accompanied their mother whenever she came to visit, and we enjoyed the time playing together. But I have no memory of them being there during the incident. I can't talk with Happy because she died many years ago in 1974. Billy, my grandfather, is in his mid-80s and still lives in Oklahoma. I'll call him soon, but I don't hold out much hope that he'll remember anything. His memory is failing. If she can't remember the incident, I'll bet that Billy has forgotten it, too. I wish Happy were alive. She would remember. I got to say that I'm filled with a profound sense of relief. This must be what is called a missing time episode. Even though Mother is unable to confirm the incident, I am now positive that it happened as I've described it here in its major details. The memory of my grandmother becoming more and more excited about a fireball in the driveway and something about people at the front door is very real in my mind now. The speculation about a lightning strike and the reason for dismissing that explanation are just as vivid a memory. I know that this happened, and it doesn't matter if I can prove it or not, because now I know I'm not having a nervous breakdown. That has been a very real concern of mine during the last month and a half. I thought that maybe I had become hysterical, taking a molehill of little things that might easily be explained and making out of it a mountain big enough to bury me. But now I know that is not the case. Something did happen those many years ago, and it's probably been happening to me off and on ever since. I'm going to stop there and take one more break so you can listen to this informative message.
The National Lawyers Guild is dedicated to the need for basic change in the structure of our political and economic systems. They seek to unite lawyers, law students, legal workers, and jailhouse lawyers of America to function as an effective political and social force in the service of the people, to the end that human rights shall be regarded as more sacred than mere property interests. For more information about your legal rights, how to obtain legal assistance, or to donate, please contact the National Lawyers Guild at nlgsg.org. That's nlgsg.org. This public service announcement is brought to you by your friends at Mutiny Radio.
Close Encounters is produced at Mutiny Radio, located at 21st Street and Florida in San Francisco. Besides hosting a wide variety of podcasts each week, Mutiny Radio serves the community as a venue for a host of entertainment and educational programs. We also have a 40-seat performance space available for rent. So if you're a performer looking for a really cheap place to put on a show, give our station director Pam Benjamin a call at 760-716-3865. That's area code 760-716-3865. That's our show for tonight. Here's one more selection by Vangelis, the title track from his album, Albedo 0.39, in which he describes planet Earth in scientific terms. Until next time, know that life is only an illusion, so don't take it so seriously. Good night.
Maximum distance from the sun, 94,537,000 miles. Minimum distance from the sun, 91,377,000 miles. Mean distance from the sun, 92,957,200 miles. Mean orbital velocity, 66,000 miles per hour. Orbital eccentricity, 0.017. Obliquity of the ecliptic, 23 degrees, 27 minutes, 8.26 seconds. Thank you. length of the tropical year, equinox to equinox, 365.24 days. Length of the sidereal year, fixed star to fixed star, 365.26 days. Length of the mean solar day, 24 hours, 3 minutes, 56.555 seconds in mean solar time. Length of the mean sidereal day, 23 hours, 56 minutes, 4.091 seconds in mean solar time. Mass, 6,600,000,000,000,000 tons. Equatorial diameter, 7,927 miles. Polar diameter, 7,900 miles. Oblateness, 1,298. Density, 5.41. Mean surface gravitational acceleration of the rotating Earth, 32.174 feet per second per second. Escape velocity, 7 miles per second. Albedo, 0.39. Albedo, 0.39.